From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As protests continue to rage across the country, speaking out about racist police violence, President Donald Trump has chosen to view the mass dissent as dominated by the violence of protesters rather than by the violence of police. He has threatened to deploy the U.S. military on American soil against those he says are fomenting anarchy and chaos. But there's a growing trend among liberals as well to draw a distinction between good protesters, i.e. those who are marching and congregating, and bad protesters, those who are setting fire to police cars, smashing store windows, and pilfering products. Many suggest that white extremists have infiltrated progressive movements and are attempting to discredit the demand for Black Lives to Matter. My guest is Arun Gupta. He's an investigative journalist who's written for dozens of publications, including The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, Salon and Raw Story, and The Intercept. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction. He's a regular news correspondent for Rising Up with Sonali. He has a new piece out in Indies Times magazine. Welcome to the program, Arun.
Thanks for having me today, Sonali.
So you are someone who has spent many years looking at protest movements, Occupy Wall Street, you know, left protest movements, as well as at extremist right-wing groups, militias, and some of these groups that have become more prominent during the Trump administration. How do you view this conversation that is playing out right now on social media and in the media discourse about good versus bad protesters? Even Joe Biden in his speech on Tuesday wanted to draw this distinction between those who are being violent and those who aren't, and Trump did as well.
Well, let's be clear. It's the police who are being violent. The police are the outside agitators. Many of them do not live in their communities. They are the extremists. It's well known that a lot of white nationalists, white supremacists go into police departments. Police agencies often turn a blind eye to actual white nationalist violence. There was an incident in Philadelphia yesterday in the South Philadelphia where there were dozens of men carrying weapons, white men carrying weapons, like baseball bats. They approached the police and said they wanted to help protect them. Now, the police were like, you know, they demurred and, you know, just said that we don't need your help. But they didn't do anything to arrest them. Could you imagine if there were dozens of anarchists who were walking down the streets with weapons? They would have attacked them instantly. So there are two different narratives that we have going on here. One is coming from Trump, Fox News, and, you know, just a lot of the basically propagandists, fascist enablers that you find throughout social media, that Antifa is this terrorist organization. You know, there are all these people who have significant social media followings claiming, you know, that there's all these revolutionary cells and they're going to cause chaos and want to overthrow the government, which is completely absurd. Antifa, of course, is not an organization at all. It's just a tactic and an idea. It means anti-fascist. And when you have a government that explicitly outlaws anti-fascism, it's basically saying, we're the fascists. Mm-hmm. So then you also have this liberal narrative. And this starts out of Minneapolis, where you have mayors out there who initially just make the most absurd allegations. It wasn't just that, oh, these are like white anarchists. It was they were white nationalists. The mayor of Minneapolis actually said drug cartels and foreign agents, which is completely ridiculous. The governor then picked up on this. You have media figures like Joanne Reed for MSNBC, who's been promoting this, which is just an utter lie. I've been looking into it. Now, the thing is, this is a very fluid and complex situation. I think there's also a real problem that I'm seeing with a lot of progressives and liberals and leftists, where they want things to fit into neat little boxes. And I've been covering riots. I was in New York City when the Rodney King riots happened. And so I've been seeing these things for nearly 30 years now. And they're just absolutely chaotic situations. People take advantage of them. People get drawn into them. You know, they do things that they would not normally do. They get caught up in the heat of the moment. And, you know, people do have political agendas as well. But this is not limited to one race or the other. I've been looking at lots of videos of New York City, my neighborhood in particular, the Lower East Side. I'm not going out onto the streets because of the risk of coronavirus. And you will see a lot of brown and black youth who are going into stores and looting. And it's just like, this is a social explosion because people have been pent up. There's been this pressure that's been absolutely building for months. So this idea that this is these white extremists or white nationalists is absurd, or this idea that just because you're an anarchist, you don't have legitimate grievances is also just, I think, a noxious idea because police are very violent towards anarchists. Yes, many of whom, majority, are anarchists.
So there's a convenience to having a narrative that the noble black and brown protesters who are, you know, from communities that are the primary victims of police violence want to have the sit-ins, want to invoke Martin Luther King Jr.'s style of protesting, and it's the privileged white activists who are putting everybody in harm's way, who are spray painting walls or smashing store windows. And there may be some of that, but it doesn't seem to me that that is the whole story. And that narrative just seems a little too convenient, right?
Oh, yeah, very much so. And I think the reason you see this coming from Democrats in particular is because they don't want to admit their own failures. Minneapolis is one of the has some of the most extreme racial polarization in the country, and it is liberal from top to bottom. The city, the county, the state, every single leader is a Democrat, and they have completely failed the African American community. And we have to remember, when we see these types of uprisings and revolts, is an indictment of failed leadership across the board. So Occupy Wall Street, when it happened, it wasn't just an indictment of, you know, capitalists and Wall Street and Democrats and Republicans. It was also an indictment of the failures of the media, of liberals, of the left, of unions that had failed to advocate for people. And so this is very much a revolt. Again, it's against like Trump's ethno-nationalism, against the violence of the state, the racist police violence, but it's also an indictment of the failed black political leadership. Let's be clear about that, that, you know, the black political leaders who are now trying to tamp this down, they certainly do not speak to these youth. They do not speak for these youth. And even if they were once of them, they are not of them now. You know, if we remember in 2016, we had the kind of ridiculous sight of John Lewis, who is an icon, civil rights icon, telling people there's no such thing as no free lunch and you can't have a taxpayer-funded college education. And this is, of course, comes after just these trillion-dollar bailouts to the Wall Street, and he's trying to tell people there's no such thing as no free lunch. So hope is stolen from these kids. And, you know, it also doesn't, I think another thing to recognize, it just does not acknowledge their reality, that they are enculturated in this acquisitive capitalist society. And so why is it a surprise that a lot of them want to go looting? You know, they get to smash stuff, they get to destroy stuff. There was a great little piece vignette in a New York Times article from yesterday where the security guard was saying, like, people get carried away and they do stuff that they never dreamed of thought of doing. And then he reveals he was joining in the looting, even though he was a security guard for apparently one of these luxury stores. Mm. And people get swept up in the moment. We need to just recognize this is the reality of human nature.
The Washington Post had a piece on Monday entitled "White Instigators to Blame for Mayhem in Some Protests, Local Officials Say." And it centers around the story of a 20-year-old young white man named Brian Jordan Bartels, who essentially had a warrant placed against him for instigating or for kicking off or sparking the escalation of a protest in Pittsburgh. And his name has been passed around a lot. His photo, you know, he's a young white man wearing a bandana around his face. He's clad in all black. He's wearing a hoodie. So he sort of fits that description of the black bloc anarchist type kid. But are people overblowing this sort of reaction? And even if he's a white kid, does his anger over racism mean less, even if he might have, you know, used tactics that are unsavory?
Well, you know, you would have to ask people on the street, and I've been talking to people on the street, and there's been this history of a lot of people who disagreed with property destruction.
It's an age-old debate on the left.
right. You know, it goes back to Seattle WTO 1999. Yeah. And what's interesting this time is you're seeing very little disagreement. The windows will be replaced. The Coach handbags will be replaced. The Gucci apparel will all be replaced. What's not going to be replaced is George Floyd and all the other black people who've been murdered by police. And in the last few days, we've also seen other people who've been murdered. There was a young black man in Omaha who was murdered by a bar owner who is allegedly a notorious racist and transphobe. And it takes the officials there barely a day to say, like, oh, it was self-defense. There was a black man, a restaurant owner in Louisville, who was murdered by the police and National Guard. And they claimed there were shots fired. And now there's all these evidence that there were no shots fired. They just killed them. You know, and there's all these horrifying videos of police just shooting people in the head and the face with these less lethal weapons and nearly killing them. A lot of African Americans. And so we've got to stop this pearl clutching over some smash windows and these luxury goods stores that they're probably going to make more money in the end because nobody's been coming to the store and now they're going to get all these insurance payouts.
LAPD Chief Michael Moore got into trouble for claiming on Monday that the looters were as responsible for the death of George Floyd as the police in Minneapolis. So the police are very happy to put the idea of looting on the same level as police violence, and that feeds so unfortunately some liberals seem to fall into the trap of feeding into that narrative, elevating the moral, you know, disapproval of looting so much that you lose sight of the fact that it's the police that are, you know, continuing to foment violence. They're literally attacking unarmed protesters and, of course, obscuring the reason for the protest in the first place. And it's interesting because, of course, even the protesters who might be vandalizing and looting, as you said, they're destroying property that can be replaced. The police are the ones destroying and attacking people. Nationwide, there have been, so far as we know, I believe it was Reuters found out that a total of 5 police officers have been injured. One is in critical condition, and this is nationwide. Meanwhile, there have been more than 5,000 people arrested and several people killed. As you mentioned, the restaurant owner in Louisville, Kentucky, black folks that have been killed. So that, it seems to me, is something that we're losing sight of in accepting this narrative that the Joe Bidens are putting forward.
Yeah, and let's also be, we need to push back hard. And, you know, all this stuff is basically, it's replicating those Southern segregationist senators, sheriffs, and politicians who would talk about outside agitators and extremists stirring up trouble among the Negroes. I mean, this is basically the same thing. And it's no different if it's liberals who are pushing it, or even black elected political leaders. They are trying to basically cover up responsibility for their own failures. And that comment, you know, by a number of police chiefs, they're absolutely disgusting. You know, it's just like Los Angeles is one of the most murderous police forces out there. They have killed hundreds and hundreds of African-American men in the 2000s, and not one of them has been brought to justice, not one. At one point, I believe in a 15-year period, it was over 300 that were killed in the 2000s. And this is, of course, the city of Rodney King.
Right. And let me actually mention specifically what it was that LAPD Chief Michael Moore said. He said that that his death, George Floyd's death, is as much on their hands, that is the looters' hands, the people engaged in the destruction of commercial property, as much as it is those officers. He has reportedly now walked back those comments. I'm wondering, Arun, if you think that it might be instructive for those of us who are sort of tempted to fall into this trap of good versus bad protester, to think about how we view, say, you know, protests in Hong Kong, mass protests happening in a city that is trying to rid itself of Chinese oppression, Chinese government oppression. There is some vandalism, there's some breaking of windows, there's a lot more violence by the police against protesters. And most Americans kind of can see clearly that the cause of the Hong Kongers is just, and that some looting and vandalism doesn't take away from their cause and is sort of a, you know, a minimal issue compared to the violence that police are wreaking on the actual protesters. We should be looking at our protests in the same way, right?
I completely agree. I think this is also an opportunity for a valuable historical lesson that this is basically a redux of 1848, because what there when you had, you know, really the first outbreak of all these workers' revolutions, there was a choice for the petty bourgeois, the emerging kind of professional middle class, of do they side with the workers or do they side with this kind of a murderous state, and they sided with the state, they sided with order. And we also have to recognize the reality that when push comes to shove, a lot of liberals are going to side with this fascist order, and they won't admit it, but the reality is a lot of liberals understand that their social reproduction is based on the brutal violence of this racist policing, and so they are quick to protect property because they want to protect their own property rights. So this is a complex issue, but we don't tear it down by turning our heads away from what's really going on here.
There's also a lot of conspiracy theories floating around about how cops are trying to provoke protesters into, you know, being tempted into doing something that can get them arrested. There's this whole idea that there's police or right-wing white supremacists going around leaving piles of bricks. I don't know if you've seen this in cities to tempt protesters to use them as projectiles. I don't know why the cops would do such a thing, because they would be the ones facing a brick projectile, which could literally kill you if it hits you in the head. NBC did an investigation into it and has debunked this series of rumors, saying that these are false. But a lot of, you know, like my Facebook friends have posted this and are tempted to believe it.
Social media is a cesspool of lies, disinformation, and division.
That's it. Speaking of social media, Twitter has taken down one account that was by a group, Identity Europa, which is a white supremacist, extremist, you know, fascist organization that attempted to, they basically created this account, Antifa_US, where they basically posed as Black Lives Matter advocates and encouraged violence and, you know, brown-colored fist emoji in the air. And Twitter took this down. And this is another thing that a lot of people have jumped onto, saying, see, the extremist fascist right wing is going to attempt to provoke us into violence. What do you make of this?
I think that's certainly true, but I think, you know, this paranoia is very destructive. You know, I'll quickly mention there's this video that's been circulating for days. It's Umbrella Man. It's this guy who's dressed in black. He's smashing windows in Minneapolis, and he's carrying an umbrella because that's what a tactic picked up from Hong Kong protesters. He has on a gas mask, and people are convinced, oh, this guy's a cop, and
But it's a very high-tech looking gas mask, looks fancy, so yeah.
I've been in over a dozen different riots, and I've seen more than 100 guys like them in cities in Washington, in Seattle, in Portland, in numerous cities, and this is in New York. This is nothing new. I mean, there's a flavor of it, anarchists who call themselves insurrectionists, who are trying to, you know, basically speed up the class struggle in their own opinion. And I think they're a little bit high on their own politics, but this is not something sinister. And I think people who keep seeing like cops everywhere, one, it makes everyone paranoid. It also creates all these divisions in the movement. As we've said, it's basically doing the cops dirty work for them. And it's just simply not true. This is a moment where you're going to get people with 100 different motives, and people's motives change over the course of one night. And people have conflicting motives. We have to understand this is a moment of multiplicity in terms of actors and why people are doing what they're doing, and to basically stop with the paranoia.
And to do your homework before you post something on social media, that's so important. There's also it's also, of course, important for us to understand that the police are and the FBI are going to take the vandalism of stores much, much more seriously than they're going to take their own forces hurting people. The LA Times on Tuesday announced that the LAPD and the FBI were working together to collect protest footage as evidence for future arrests. They're building the cases for people whose faces they can see on their screens. But of course, they're not asking, and they put a call out for footage. They're not putting a call out for documentation of police violence. And there is plenty of documentation of police violence. Basically, police just pepper spraying people in the face as they're backing away, children, pregnant women, elderly people, beating them down, ganging up and beating them down. But the FBI doesn't seem interested in collecting that footage.
Yeah, no, I mean, and we have to remember, this just comes a few weeks after all those reopened protests, where you have these white nationalist mobs with guns who are invading state houses, and Trump is praising them as very fine people again, just like he praised neo-Nazis who just murdered someone as very fine
In
people. I mean,
Charlottesville, yeah.
In 2017. And you know, it's just like the photo op. I mean, you know, can we just like, you know, dispense with this? Is a fascist government. It may be an inept, it may be clownish and grifting, but they are fascists. That photo op was classic sword and cross fascism, where they're violently attacking protesters so he can go hold up a Bible in front of a church. And is this the government we want? Are these the people who we want in charge of the government? This is really spiraling out of control.
Meanwhile, Trump's main rival, Joe Biden, who gave a decent-ish speech on Tuesday, only a day earlier, suggested flippantly to black congregants at a church in Delaware that the police should, you know, aim for the legs if they're going to shoot a suspect instead of aiming for the heart. That was his solution to police violence.
Well, you know what? It's just like he sounded like Yitzhak Rabin, who told Israeli soldiers to break the bones of young Palestinian boys who were throwing rocks at Israelis during the first Intifada in the late 1980s. And, you know, one thing that has really struck me in a way, this is kind of the Palestinianization of black and brown youth in America. They've essentially been imprisoned for months. They're watching their elders die off. We have to remember, it's just like, how many of these kids have seen parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles succumb to coronavirus? They didn't have much of a future before. Now with 40 million unemployed, they have no future at all. And so it's when Trump was elected, I kept saying he's bringing the war on terror home, and that is essentially what we have seen. The tactics and tools of the war on terror are being applied to the American public. And of course, I don't want to say it's exactly like what's going on in occupied Palestine. That's absolutely horrifying. But there is kind of this analogy that we can draw. And of course, Israelis train many of the U.S. Police departments in these brutal tactics. So there is this kind of like grand historical trend that we can see.
Meanwhile, presidential candidate, former presidential candidate, Senator Bernie Sanders has been tweeting about who the real looters are, trying to draw attention to Wall Street. He also quoted Coretta Scott King in reminding us that poverty is violence. We don't unfortunately see enough of that from politicians. I want to segue to another story, Arun. As these protests are plaguing the country, or I shouldn't say plaguing the country, really sweeping the country as a very important moment in our history, we still are in the middle of a pandemic, a viral pandemic that is continuing to take lives and that could be spreading, unfortunately, even at these protests. And some of our most vulnerable people in society also continue to still suffer from a lack of adequate protective equipment. You recently wrote a piece in These Times magazine. Your latest article was trying to draw attention to migrant farm workers and how COVID-19 is spreading there. In the last few minutes of our conversation, tell me a little bit about the investigation that you did with your co-author, Michelle Fawcett, and why it's important for us to pay attention to this issue.
So there are approximately an estimated 2.5 million farm workers in the country. We've heard a lot about the outbreaks in the meat processing plants, where you have well over 15,000 cases at this point, dozens of workers who died. And it's the conditions in the plants that are causing the outbreaks. Workers are working shoulder to shoulder. It's this fast-paced job. It's this cold environment, which allows the coronavirus to thrive. But in the farms where people are picking your fruits, your vegetables, it's the living conditions that's turning them into hothouses of coronavirus outbreaks. And so in farms in upstate New York, there was a one nursery where 100 a greenhouse where 170 workers came down sick. In North Carolina, there's been out breaks on five different farms in Washington State and all these orchards and fruit packing houses and all these rural areas also where you find a lot of migrant farm workers, such as in Oregon or in California, like Monterey County in California. There's a huge number of cases among the farm worker population because for migrant farm workers in particular, those are ones who move with the harvest, and those also include the approximately 270,000 H-2A workers who are shipped in from out of country. They are packed into these dorms. They live in bunk beds. North Carolina, for instance, by law, they can have as little as 50 square feet per person. So you'll find like a room that's, maybe the size of a living room with six young men living in there. They only need to have one shower head for every 10 people, one toilet for every 15. And so it's these living conditions that are causing them to spread. And if you are if and so what this means is if the farm worker force is starting to fall sick, we're going to also start to see a potential shortage of fruit and vegetables. And we've already seen problems in terms of farming because a lot of farmers, they were selling to institutions, restaurants and schools and that sort transport processing plants. And now that so many of them have closed down, we've seen mountains of potatoes rotting, just huge amount of food going to waste that they couldn't sell. And so they made a lot of them have chosen not to grow stuff. So this can really work its way through the pipeline, but there's all sorts of problems going on with the farm workers themselves because a lot of them are afraid to get tested because they'll lose their job. They don't have sick leave. They don't have job guarantees. They don't have medical insurance. And so these coronavirus infections can often start completely undetected and then sweep through the farm population. And some advocates describe it in their words that these farm workers are making death pacts so that they're going to keep silent if they have the infection because they're afraid if it's found out, everyone is going to lose their job. And so this is really just kind of like this horrifying stealth outbreak that is going on across the country.
Well, Arun, we'll post a link to the article that you wrote in These Times magazine from our website. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Sonali.
My guest is Arun Gupta, an investigative journalist who's written for dozens of publications, including In These Times, The Intercept, The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, Salon, and Raw Story. His forthcoming book is Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction. He's a regular news correspondent for our program. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingup@sonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.